The following program is brought to you by Total Theater Online. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the staff or management of WGBB. You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Well, there goes the neighborhood. Welcome, everybody, to Dave's Gone By, an hour of talk radio, comedy, and music on this Thursday, October 14th, 2004. This is our 97th episode. Was going to call it the wreck of the old 97, but it isn't a wreck at all. As a matter of fact, we've got a ton of stuff to do tonight. First and foremost, a special guest, a woman who's directing a revival of one of the most popular plays of the last couple of decades, Crimes of the Heart. Pamela Scott visits the neighborhood tonight. Beth Henley, of course, wrote the show. Won a Pulitzer for it. It was later made into a movie with Diane Keaton and Sissy Spacek and Jessica Lange. And the show keeps getting done all over the country. It hasn't had a Broadway revival yet. There was an off-Broadway one 3 years ago, and now another off-Broadway mounting at the T. Schreiber Studio, 151 West 26th Street in Manhattan. Now, T. Schreiber sounds familiar. That's because I interviewed him a few months ago on this program, Terry Schreiber. Really fun to talk to, and we spoke about acting and directing and actor training, and we're going to go back in that vein tonight with my special guest, Pamela Scott, directing Crimes of the Heart at the Schreiber Studio. Pamela's also written a bunch of plays, and she's been an acting teacher for several years. She's a graduate of and a faculty member of the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And over the years, she's taken classes with everyone from Betty Buckley to Gina Gershon to Don Johnson. So she's got anecdotes and pointed observations to make about theater and performance. So stay with us for that. Also on the program, part two of my chat with Neil Innes. Unofficially the seventh Python, officially the first or second Ruddle, also a friend to the Beatles, an original Bonzo, and a quirky, catchy singer-songwriter in his own right. Neil was in town to play B.B. King's Blues Club on Sunday. He's on an East Coast tour, and I was hoping to spend about half an hour talking with him about all these aspects of his career. Everything from having a cameo in the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour movie to working with Monty Python's Eric Idle on sketches for Saturday Night Live. Well, we talked for more than an hour. Just a delightful conversation. And rather than chop it into nothing, I'm letting it roll and play out over two or three episodes, as I'm doing with the Tom Paxton interview I did a couple of weeks back. So, last week, Neil Innes and I talked about the early years, forming the Bonzo Dog Band, working with some of the Pythons, pre-Python, on Do Not Adjust Your Set, meeting the Beatles for the first time. But there's so much more, especially Neil's close friendship with George Harrison and his years working with and on Monty Python's Flying Circus. It turns out, Neil wrote one of my very favorite Python sketches. You'll find out which if you stay tuned now till 8 o'clock on Dave's Gone By. Brought to you by Total Theater, publishers of Performing Arts Insider magazine, Quiznos of Hewlett for tasty, toasty sandwiches, yum, and Hewlett Minuteman Press, printing, copying, binding, and every other ing you can think of. And if you think of another ing, by all means, please share it with the rest of us. Write to me at davesgoneby@aol.com. And I am the Dave of Dave's Gone By, Dave Lefkowitz, radio personality, theater critic, journalist, and humorist, every week filling this program with smart talk, silly talk, special talk, and music. All of it rated DGB-13, that's the Dave's Gone By equivalent of PG-13, and even that is being overly cautious. But hey, Howard Stern gets to jump to satellite. We're still stuck in analog, so better safe than sorry. And you won't be sorry you stayed for this episode of Dave's Gone By, which gets underway with Inside Broadway right after this. I've been telling you for months why you should use Hewlett Minuteman Press for all your copying and printing needs, but here's one of the owners, Mike Toron, to tell you why.
Hi, how you doing? At Minuteman Press, our ultimate goal is service. We are your best source for the most complete line of printed products. You can check us out on the web at www.hewlett.minutemanpress.com.
Inside Broadway, brought to you by Total Theater's Performing Arts Insider, your everything theater guide. If Mary Tyler Moore was television's sweetheart, and Julia Roberts is America's sweetheart at the movies, I think it's fair to say that Broadway's sweetheart is Mary Louise Parker. She started there, getting her first big break in Prelude to a Kiss, first opposite Alec Baldwin, and then Timothy Hutton, who soon became her boyfriend. After Prelude, Parker didn't do a huge amount of theater, but a couple of roles proved choice, like playing Cherie in a revival of Picnic. That's where she met another ex-beau, Billy Crudup, or her unforgettable turn as Lil Bit in Paula Vogel's Pulitzer-winning How I Learned to Drive. And in 2000, she starred in another Pulitzer-winning play, Proof, a great performance that won Parker pretty much every acting award that year. She's done a lot of movies, too, with Fried Green Tomatoes probably her best known. And one of her film roles was in Longtime Companion, scripted by Craig Lucas, the guy who wrote Prelude. But ironically, Parker wasn't cast in the film version of Prelude to a Kiss. She wasn't a big star. Meg Ryan was. And recently, Parker wasn't even cast in the upcoming movie version of Proof. Gwyneth Paltrow grabbed it. Parker did appear in the movie version of another Lucas play, Reckless, but she had a small role, with Mia Farrow getting the lead. Now, Parker gets the top role in Reckless, as this dark comedy returns to the New York stage. Manhattan Theater Club and Second Stage Theater are co-producing this revival, which opens at the Biltmore Theater tonight, October 14th. Back in 1988, Reckless was one of the last hits out of Circle Repertory, the Greenwich Village institution that was a home to everyone from William Hurt to Longford Wilson. Circle Rep introduced playwright Lucas as a unique voice, making elements of fantasy, dark comedy, romance, and harsh reality all tumble together. Reckless is a perfect example. It's Christmas Eve, and the woman with a seemingly ideal home life realizes her husband has put a contract out on her life. She jumps out the window and into a strange and outlandish journey with a lot of bizarre and sometimes scary new acquaintances. And her worst fear is that it all could be nothing more than one big Freudian nightmare in her head. Sounds like an ideal part for Parker, who gets to play opposite Michael O'Keefe, Deborah Monk, and Rosie Perez. Again, that's at Broadway's Biltmore Theater on West 47th Street, opening tonight with Mark Brokaw directing. Will Reckless be a revival to recommend or to reject? The best way to find out is by subscribing to Performing Arts Insider Theater Magazine. If it's on stage in New York, theater, cabaret, opera, and dance, Performing Arts Insider has it. Variety doesn't have this information, Backstage doesn't have it, the New York Times don't got it, even Theatrical Index does not contain all the comprehensive content of Performing Arts Insider. Call 516-295-1511 or visit TotalTheater.com for subscription information. 516-295-1511. The current issue of Performing Arts Insider is available at the Drama Bookshop in Manhattan, or you can order it directly from Total Theater for just $10. That's nearly a third off the cover price and includes all postage. 516-295-1511 or email paipress@aol.com. No theater lover should be without Performing Arts Insider. I don't generally review shows on Inside Broadway. This is more of an informational preview kind of segment, but I will break with tradition to remind you that Golda's Balcony, starring Tova Feldshuh, has its one-year anniversary tomorrow. The play opened at Broadway's Helen Hayes Theater, October 15, 2003. It's a riveting look at the life of Golda Meir, former Prime Minister of Israel during some of that country's most difficult times. What really struck me about Golda's Balcony is that, although it's a one-woman show, it is so well-structured, it has so much going on, and the plot is so tense, it feels just as full as a drama with 10 characters and a dozen different sets. Golders Balcony actually debuted as a more traditional play years ago with Anne Bancroft starring. But William Gibson revised it into a solo, setting it during the Yom Kippur War with Golda's back against the wall. She begs the United States for help and threatens to go nuclear if Israel's very existence is at stake. So not only do you get the backstory of Golda's life, born in Russia, raised in Milwaukee, married to a sweet but incompatible husband. She was a tremendously influential Zionist trying to create the State of Israel, and this was long before the Holocaust, but certainly after it as well. And then her golden years as labor minister and foreign minister, even before she became prime minister. It's all there in Golda's Balcony. I can't recommend the show strongly enough. I know Tova Feldshaw got most of the credit and award consideration when the show opened last fall, and she certainly deserves the accolades, and she is still in it. You see the show, you see her. But it's not just her, it's the play itself. See it at the Helen Hayes Theater on West 44th Street, just one of the many shows we talk about on Broadway, inside Broadway.
We've just been inside Broadway with Total Theater and Performing Arts Insider.
Hey, baby. For a good time, don't call me. Read Dave Lefkowitz's book, Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World. It's got all these funny comedies in it. They make you laugh. They make you think. They make you... ooh... Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World, 516-295-1511, or davesgoneby.com. If you like Dave on the air, you'll love him between the covers.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com. Back in January, I think it was, we talked to Terry Schreiber, who is a director and acting teacher and a really nice guy with a lot of good stories about learning and teaching and the process of acting, and it was great to talk to him. Well, he has a theater, an acting studio, as well as a production house called the T. Schreiber Studio. And playing there through, I think, October 24th, it is, a revival of Beth Henley's comedy drama, mostly comedy, Crimes of the Heart. Now, why should you go out and see this production, since obviously there was a Broadway mounting of it a bunch of years ago that won the Pulitzer Prize and has been made into a movie. So what is special about this staging of this very popular play, Crimes of the Heart? Well, I figured I'd go to the source and ask the person who is directing it. Her name is Pamela Scott, and she's done a bunch of directing over the years and teaching at places like the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, where she is not only a graduate but part of their faculty. She's also studied with Sandra Seacat, who's a pretty well-known acting teacher and has had some rather famous classmates, whom I'll be asking about. Hello, Pamela Scott.
Hello, Dave. How are you?
I am good. How's Crimes of the Heart shaping up?
Oh, it's shaping up beautifully. The cast is lovely. They're terrific. It's a wonderful, lovely play filled with that mix of tragedy and comedy, which is tricky to do, but a lot of fun.
Was it your decision to stage the play, or did Terry come to you and say, well, you know, this would really be good because we have a lot of women actresses and...
It was sort of mutual, trying to find a play that did have good parts for women in it. And so that was one that we were fond of from a long time ago. So
if the listeners aren't, you know, or don't remember or don't know the piece, just very quickly, what is it about?
It's about three sisters in Hazelhurst, Mississippi, that basically are trying to learn how to handle the bad days. The one sister, the youngest sister, has shot her husband, who is a senator. She was trying to kill him, but she missed. The other sister, it's her birthday, and she can't have children, and she's upset about that. It's her 30th birthday. And the play takes place in 1974, so it's a little different being 30. In 74, a little different than it is now. And then the other sister is back in town to see about the youngest sister, and she was the one who has a reputation. She was known as cheap Christmas trash all over Copiah County. So it's just a mix of wacky characters that come in, and a nosy neighbor, and a lawyer, and an old boyfriend. So basically, they all get together.
And you were familiar with the play, I guess, before this time. I mean, you've probably seen it and read it before, or even worked on scenes with it?
Yes, lots of scenes get done in acting classes from this play. And I had seen the original Broadway production.
Mary Beth Hurt was in that, and who else?
It was like 20 years ago. I think it was it Mia Dillon?
Yes.
And then, of course, I saw the movie and then read the play, and so it was always had a fond place in my heart, so it was good to be bringing these characters to life again.
So directing the piece as a whole, did you learn anything new from the script? Did something jump out at you and say, oh, this is about this, or some moment that you never got before suddenly came to you and you were like, oh, my gosh.
I probably learned a lot through the directing of it. On how difficult it is to do that mix of comedy and drama, because if you step over one side, you have a drama. If you step over the other side, you have a comedy that doesn't have the drama, and you need both.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, as a director, that was the most that I learned through that, of working through that.
What are some of the plays that really influenced you the most, your favorite plays, or if not that, then roles as you were an actress coming up?
Yeah, roles, I guess... I've done a lot of showcase roles and a lot of writing and things like that, so that was a lot of fun. But I guess I do love this play, of course.
Right.
I like Paula Vogel's work, too, and a lot of How I Learned to Drive was, a terrific, terrific play. Shakespeare, of course.
Who?
That guy. That guy.
The bard guy,
So,
he didn't really write them anyway. It was his wife or Thomas Middleton or someone.
Yes. And I did a play at the Academy that's kind of an odd play at times, but I loved it. It was Vinegar Tom by Carol Churchill.
So here's the question that all the acting, well, pretty much anybody in any profession gets asked, but actors especially, at what point when you were young did you realize ...
that I wanted to be an actor?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember doing shows as a little kid.
Uh-huh.
I grew up outside of Detroit, and I would put on shows when I was about 6 or 7 years old and actually charge people a nickel. And I would lip sync to Elvis Presley, and then I started, writing plays by hand and putting on those shows. And so it was pretty early on. I would say 7 or 8, I probably knew. And I always used to write, too. I would get out of bed in the middle of the night and write down story ideas and, act out things. So it was pretty much there.
But then you were able to pursue it. I mean, you went to East Michigan University. Did you major in theater at that point?
Yes, I did. I majored in theater and minored in literature.
Mm-hmm.
And then I quit in my senior year when I auditioned for the Academy. I quit school in my senior year, and my dad was very supportive. He said, well, your goal wasn't to be a college graduate. It was to be an actor, so go ahead and go. So I came out to New York and went to the American Academy for 3 years and graduated, and then I did end up, getting my bachelor's degree a few years later.
And were you in any off-Broadway or major off-Broadway or Broadway productions?
No, nothing major. I did one show at the Public Theater.
What show?
It was with the Latino Festival.
Okay.
Peggy and Jackson. So.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Sorry, I.
That's okay.
Just Pep had so many shows going through there at one point. It was like, it's hard to. But was that tough for you? Going through and then. Because a lot of times you'll hear people interview actors on stuff, and, well, they went through this period, and then they got the part or the role on the sitcom or something. And you, I assume, were trying to make a living and as an actress and make your name. Was there a point when you suddenly said, wait a minute, it's not, I'm working, but I'm not really making a living at this, and it's not going to happen?
It didn't really happen like that. More what did take place was I was working. I was waitressing nights for years, and I would do all the workshops during the day and auditions and things like that. And what began to happen as I started studying with Sandra Seacat was I started writing more than I had been. And the writing started to come to the front burner. And the acting slowly got pushed to the back burner. I started, at first when I started writing, I was putting myself in my plays. You know, the first one or two one acts that I did, I acted in, and then I started, you know, producing and directing and stuff like that. So it kept getting pushed back. And I find that everything I do related to theater, you know, or film or the business, I just love it so much that, you know, it hasn't been like I miss acting. I still love acting, and that, and, you know, I still do it once in a while, but mostly it was, you know, I kept being pulled in other directions too, which I really loved.
So you've been really concentrating then to some level on the directing, but also on writing plays.
Right.
And I noticed that one of the questions I was going to ask towards the very end is on your resume on, I think it's the American Dramatic Arts Academy thing,
mm-hmm.
It says that you're in the middle of writing two or three screenplays, as we all are. But is that selling out, or is that just part of the process that, well, look, if I write plays, I can write screenplays too, you know?
Well, that's I had one option a long time ago, and that's the one that was basically got me started writing again. And then it was optioned, and then I sort of took a break from that and started writing plays. And then I went back and did another script version of that. And right now it's being sent out. Terry's been very supportive with the screenplay. He really liked it, so he's sending it out, and my agent is sending it out. So hopefully something will happen with it.
Wait, you're talking about the one that was already optioned?
It was optioned a long time ago, yeah. Like 10 years ago, and then it didn't...
Oh, they didn't make it, and then it reverted. I got it.
And then it comes back, yeah.
Yeah. That's how writers live in California, on options.
Right, right.
They don't have to make anything. They just have to get it optioned for a year or two.
Right.
Why should actors go to acting school?
Well, I believe acting is something that can be learned. Yes, talent, you can't teach talent necessarily, but you can teach acting. And I've seen so much growth with students, with actors. You know, you can say one thing, you know, it's like they say, if a teacher says, you know, that 10 teachers can tell you something, then one teacher can say it, and it all comes together.
Mm.
And I've watched such growth among students that it's just, you know, you can't tell me that it can't be taught. It can. It's a wonderful thing to watch the, you know, the young actors grow to. It's really great.
Do you subscribe to any particular technique or method, or is it a synthesis of the different schools, or what?
Basically, it's a lot of synthesis. I would probably lean more towards method, and, you know, more of the sense memory and exercises like that. I do a lot of that and relaxation. But it's also, you know, since different schools that I teach at have different time frames, I sort of sometimes have to fit within that. So I may, you know, shorten my technique or my relaxation and things like that to work within the time frame and the schools. And I learned a lot from not only Bette T. Schreiber and the Academy, but also with Sandra Seacat. So, but her work usually takes a really long time, so I can't use all of it, but it's great.
All right, it's name-dropping time, I guess. But first of all, since you've been a teacher for how many years now?
I think it's about 6 or 7 years now. 7 years now.
7 years. Yeah. So anybody that we would know of who came under your tutelage?
Not so far, no.
Okay, that's cool. Then let's reverse it. Then certainly the people that you mentioned that were classmates coming up with you,
mm-hmm.
is a little bit of a who's who here. We can just, any memories that you have of these folks, good or ill or both, people like Betty Buckley?
Yes, she was in a class with Sandra and with one workshop. And she was lovely to work with. She was pretty amazing because she would just give her all when she was on stage. She would just, it just oozed out of her.
But it wasn't a singing thing. This was purely
acting.
This
was an acting class, yeah.
And Gina Gershon.
Yeah, she was great. She actually has a great comedic sensibility that doesn't get tapped into a lot. But we were in Scotland for 3 weeks. My teacher, Sandra, did an acting workshop there for 3 weeks.
Cool.
We had 18 actors there. Rented a castle. It's really great. And just worked on our craft from morning, noon, and night. And so So there, I can only say doing Lion in Winter at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning in a castle in Scotland.
Wow.
That it was really special. So, and Gina had a, like I said, a great comedic sensibility and was very, very talented. And that was probably, I don't know, maybe 12 years ago.
Here's a name that I wouldn't expect, and I guess that's the kind of thing we wanted to hear about Gina Gershon, is we know her for one thing, but we don't realize X, Y, and Z, that she has the potential to do these other things. So, Don Johnson.
He was terrific.
And I bet he was, like, an actor that people don't even realize he, from watching Miami Vice, that, oh, yeah, no, he has a dramatic talent, or he's really funny or something, right?
Yes, he did a scene once, and... he was going to leave. He had his driver waiting, and Sandra said, "Don, I'd like you to do it again." And he said, "I really have to go." And Sandra said, "Don, I'd like you to do it again." And so he said, "Okay." And he did it again, and she worked him through it, and it was brilliant. It was wonderful, and he was sobbing, and he was laughing, and we were all sobbing and laughing, and I saw a side of him that was just really, unfortunately, doesn't, you know, on some of the stuff, you know, you can't, on TV, you don't always have the time to get to that stuff, or, you know, or it wouldn't be appropriate in some of the TV shows. But he was a brilliant actor, is a brilliant actor.
What scene did he do? Do you remember?
He was doing a scene from Kafka.
Don Johnson does Kafka. They should put that on the marquee right now.
Yeah, and he did it beautifully. And I used to, for Sandra, one of my jobs as her assistant was to rewatch all the videotapes and write things down about it, so I would be in the workshop, and then I would tape the workshop, and then I would watch the tapes, and then I would write about the different scenes. So that was a terrific learning experience for me also.
Now, you not only, as we've said, you've done acting, and you do a lot of directing, and you're writing a lot of plays, you also founded one theater, and then also kind of a little company. So first of all, Aching Dogs Theater, which is a play on... you know, Aching Feet.
Right.
And what's that about?
Well, that is, which is a great thing, is that the union, the Hotel Restaurant Workers Union, Local 6, and the Hotel Trade Council, which is AFL-CIO, decided that they had so many members that were actors being in the restaurant business that they would fund a theater company for their members to be able to hone their craft and, you know, possibly get jobs on the outside. So they wanted to support their members who were actors. So they fund a theater company that I'm the producing artistic director. And we do one or two shows a year and cast as many members as we can. You know, usually it's between 13 and 20 members. And I also teach weekly workshops. And so they've been great about that.
And then there's also Lunch Live.
Lunch Live is something that I created because a lot of the students I was working with didn't have an opportunity to showcase, you know, either some of them I worked full-time or just couldn't find the opportunity to do a showcase. So I put together this Lunch Live where we basically feed industry, bribe them shamelessly into coming to the show by giving them a free lunch and seeing an hour show. So we put together usually between 4 and 6 short scenes, you know, 5 to 10 minute scenes, and the actors act in it, and Scotty gets industry to come to it, and we invite industry to come.
Yeah, I mean, well, being a theater critic myself for all these years, I know, and it's true about my colleagues, that, you know, they have 100 plays to choose from being in New York at any given time, but if you say, oh, you know, there's free food. I swear to God, suddenly all 90% of the other plays fall off, and it's like, well, let's see, I really want to see this one, but free food on this one, you know, I don't have to pay for dinner.
That's great. And it was also our way of saying thank you to what industry, you know, one of the things I found too is, you know, actors in the business, they're always looking for work. So this was a nice way to say thank you to people in the industry for finding work for actors.
Well, speaking of work, basically last question I want to talk to you about is, because you're doing all this writing, you have a play of your own that is going to be going up at the Producers Club, too. It's a few weeks from now. It's December 1st through 5th.
Well, this is the Aching Dogs Theater, yes.
Oh, it's the Aching Dogs. Okay, yeah.
Yes, and we're actually figuring out which plays we're we're doing yet. So I'm not 100% sure if it's going to be a play of mine or if it's going to be several one acts.
I thought it was going to be servers because there was a lot
about
servers
was done last year.
Ah, okay.
And but it, you know, we had talked about, you know, either doing servers two if I could write it fast enough, or something like that. But that was, I'm sorry for the misunderstanding. That was done last year.
And servers is about your time waitressing, I assume.
Yeah.
Your personal experience. So what's the best story that came out of that, the most memorable moment as an actress slash waitress?
Oh, let's see. The most, I guess, would be waiting on people and then on my break flying downstairs to the locker room, taking off my uniform, putting on an audition outfit, taking a cab down somewhere to, you know, go to an audition and run to an audition and then taking a cab back and running back and having my break cost me $30 or whatever in cab fare, and then putting my uniform back on and being able to, you know, go right back into, hi, what would you like to drink? Yeah.
And I guess the converse question then is, or obverse or reverse or one of the verses, is your strangest, either most wonderful or worst, audition experience?
Going in and not quite being prepared. As an actor or singer, when I first started out, I think the first audition I ever went to, we weren't really allowed to go to auditions at the Academy because they didn't want you to, you know, they wanted you to know what you were doing before you went, and good point, but I went anyways, and I didn't have a headshot or a resume, and I went in and sang a song and got the words all wrong, and then at the end they said, well, we'll call you, thank you, and I thought, well, not likely since you don't even have my number, so, but I just wanted to get the experience of being up in front of people and trying it. You know.
Well, just reminding folks that Up in Front of People right now is Crimes of the Heart. It's playing at the T. Schreiber Studio, 151 West 26th Street. Tickets are 212-352-3101. It's a classic show. It's won a Pulitzer and remains part of the American canon at this point. And directing it at the Schreiber Studio has been my guest, Pamela Scott. I want to wish you best of luck on the show. It's running to the 24th, right?
Right, right.
And so best of luck on that. Best of luck on the plays you're writing. And if there was one thing that, another bit of encouragement that you would give people who are coming up as actors and actresses, what would that be?
That would be to follow your dream. The money will come later.
I've been telling my mom and dad that for years. Now I'm telling my wife that. Now, well, but you know.
Lots of times I have many students that come to me that are older that say they wished, you know, they would have had the support to do it when they were younger. And I'm just lucky that, I feel lucky that I got the support from my family to follow my dream. And it may have changed along the years, but I'm very happy.
Well, very happy to have you here with us on the neighborhood. Pamela Scott, best of luck. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave.
Oh, honey, you turn me on. I'm the radio.
That's right, Joni. I turn you on all week long for a bunch of shows on WGBB, like Wednesday nights at 11 for psychic astrologer Joyce Keller, hosting radio's longest-running psychic advice show. She knew I'd say that. Thursday nights at 6, an hour before Dave's gone by, it's WGBB Tonight with Larry Davidson. And then, right after my show, Smooth Jazz, The Instrumental Invasion with Mike Shamiri at 8. Friday nights at 6, Bonnie D. Graham has advice about being single and singular on Long Island's dating. And things get wilder on the weekends with the Saturday Night Rock Block, starting at 7:30 with the Mr. Redman Music Show, up-and-coming Long Island rock bands, and a weekly countdown, followed by Mikey and Jimmy. It's a madhouse. It's a zoo. It's Mikey and Jimmy, Saturday nights at 9. And then, on Sundays at 7, Joe Salzone offers conservative politics with a sense of humor and an open mind on your world.
If you're driving into town, it's a dark cloud above you.
Dial in AM 1240 WGBB for Joyce Keller Wednesday nights at 11, Larry Davidson Thursdays at 6, yours truly at 7, Mike Shamiri Thursdays at 8, Bonnie D. Graham Fridays at 6, The Rock Block Saturdays from 7:30 to 10, and Joe Salzone Sundays at 7.
Call me at the station, the lights are open.
Welcome back
to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB in Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com, live streaming on the web. Well, we've already had one guest on this program, the delightful Pamela Scott. Now we have guest part two from last week, my conversation with Neil Innes, unofficially known as the Seventh Python because he worked with that troupe. He was also pretty close with a couple of the Beatles, which later led to the Rebels, and so much more. So, where we were last talking, he had met the Beatles already. He was describing how he was afraid of John Lennon, kind of. He was such a strange and powerful personality that he was almost, as he said, terrified of them. But he had a very different experience with George Harrison, and I asked him about that.
Well, George became very good friends with Eric. And I think both their marriages went a bit wrong at the same time.
Hmm.
And I was, you know, playing in a pub, and George and Eric came down, and I don't know, we just sort of hit it off, really, and George was on Rough and Weekend television and doing things. And I don't know, my wife Yvonne, who's coming on the tour with me, it's just the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
Is a very, very accomplished garden designer, and she's won several gold medals at Chelsea Flower Show and things like that. And so
uh-huh.
When we saw, you know, first time we went to Friar Park was to film some of the Cracker Box Palace videos, you know, and it's a stunning place. And so ever since then, you know, Yvonne's been helping with the garden, and, you know, we've been kind of friends ever since, and my youngest son and Danny is only a month between them, so we had a lot in common. I wrote this song called "Love Is Getting Deeper,"
mm-hmm.
which I do in a silly French accent because it's sort of a bit like Charles Aznavour. But George actually did a version of it as well because, you know, we both had young babies at the time.
When was the last time you saw him?
I think about 9 months, a year before he passed away. Well, I didn't see him looking ill.
Uh-huh.
He went away to Switzerland, and where he did look a bit ill. I mean, this is the character and strength of the man. You know, Klaus Voormann, who went to see him in Switzerland, told me that he always had this little digital camera. He was always filming things and doing things with it. And up in Switzerland, I think he had no hair.
Mm.
And he turned it on himself and said, "How does it feel to be one of the beautiful people?" He was a very, very special person. I don't think of him as gone. I think he's still here somewhere.
We've kind of covered the Beatles, but tell me more about the years with Python.
Right, well, Monty Python, so I think I mentioned, but I'll say again, when the Bontos did this television show for children called Do Not Adjust Your Set, and the writers and performers in it were Eric Idle, Michael Palin, Terry Jones, and Terry Gilliam was doing his first animated films for it too.
Right.
And it was all put together by a man called Humphrey Barclay. He was the producer, and he was sort of his inspiration to put the Bontos together with that lot, along with another actor called David Jason and an actress, a very, very funny comedienne called Denise Coffey. So anyway, that was the cast and writing crew, and we did about 26 of these things. And they became, you know, or they were very much pre-Python, you know, similar kind of thing. But at the end of the second series, the Bontos, I think it was 68, we went off to America, you know, twice. And by the time we came back, Monty Python was on the air. And the others had teamed up with John Cleese and Graham Chapman.
Right.
And I suppose a year after that, you know, the Bontos sort of split up after, you know, America, you know, 71, I think. So by then, Python had sort of got going, I mean, enough for them to sort of be asked to make records. And so Eric Idle rang me up to see if I'd come and help them with the records. And so, because we all knew each other, you know, it was very easy. I just sort of slotted in. I hadn't met Graham and John, but that didn't take long, you know.
Right.
And,
Well, actually, before getting into that, that must have been a weird transitional period for you. I mean, you just sort of said, oh, well, you know, the Bonzos broke up. But that must have been, you were with them at that point for a few years. And
yeah.
Did you think, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do now?
in many ways, you know, we didn't mean to be as busy as we were. You know, we always thought, you know, well, this is a bit of fun to do after college. You know, we'll think about what we're going to do later. And I think it's fair to say at that time in the UK, the economy was very good. And Harold Macmillan at the time had said, oh, you know, you've never had it so good, was the phrase. And people in my position, I think, who just coming out of college, didn't even think, well, what job, can I get a job? It's sort of, what job do I want? Wow. So there was none of this pressure that there probably is now on young people to sort of think out their careers or look at their options or...
When they're in junior high school, yeah.
Yeah. So there's none of that pressure. And I remember coming back from the Bonte's very last gig, you know, it was a bit of a riotous affair. And suffice to say, we were still driving when the dawn was coming up, as coming back into London. And until the dawn came up, I was thinking, oh, that's the end of that, that's the end of that. And then the dawn came up, and somebody said, well, no, it's got to be the start of something else. And sure enough, it was. And I wouldn't swap a day, you know, of the fun we had with the Bonzos. But at the same time, we were so sort of indisciplined, really, in a rather cutthroat business.
And when you have eight people in a band...
No, there was only six by then.
Oh, by then, okay. But
yeah.
Even so.
But the thing was that we didn't have a holiday. What we did was pay off three managers. But we didn't have a holiday. And I think if we'd had a holiday or something like that, the strain wouldn't have got to Vivian Stansel quite so much. And, you know, when you stop arguing, you know, I think you're creatively dead. And I think it was wise of the Bonzos to sort of say, right, we're going to stop it now while it's pretty good, and not let it fester.
Cool.
And so I moved very easily into sort of working with Python, because I know that, you know, if you do get a group of people together, that the chemistry kind of kicks off, then it's always going to be stronger than anything you can do on your own.
No, but,
Yeah, so I really enjoyed working with the Python team.
Could you just remind us of some of the sketches that you were in before that last season, where you were almost like a full-fledged member, in fact, of the cast? But
I wrote a couple of things.
You wrote a couple of
things. Chapman,
yeah.
I think it was my idea to come up with this awful family.
The most awful family of Great Britain contest?
That's it.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, notice how they ripped it off when they put the Osbournes on.
I don't think they realized it. But no, whose idea was it to do Terry Gilliam with more beans?
No, it was my idea.
Oh,
yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And what other one did you do? Or did you
although I can't remember who thought of ironing the cat. but no, I did that, and I also actually wrote appeal on behalf of the very rich. Which Graham performed.
Must have been a Graham thing, yeah. And then, so that was the first couple of seasons where you were also used for some singing stuff. Were you part of the original, were you one of the Fred Tomlinson singers?
I mean, no,
they
I
just
wasn't,
bring, okay.
No. But that was very, you know, early days, before I was, with, you know, connected with Python. Because I think they more or less sort of finishing off television, I kind of joined them.
Well, there was
apart from that last season, that's right.
Which is rather unfairly maligned. I mean, you go back and look at that last season and some of those brilliant stuff that they did.
Quite honestly, I can't remember any of it.
Oh, my gosh, Michael Ellis?
I know, I don't think I even had a VCR in those days.
There were
certainly very happy days. But, I mean, the television thing sort of wound up. And they'd already gone to Germany, I think, and done some stuff where they did the silly Olympics and what have you. But everyone got together again to do these live tours. And we did the first thing we did was a farewell tour of the UK. And then we went to Canada. And then I think we did the city centre in 1976.
Where I saw you guys, by the way.
Ah.
Very proud to say. How old was I? We were 12.
Well, nearly every night there was a different guest amongst the Mounties, and it was quite interesting to see who was there. I mean, George did it one night,
mm-hmm.
and so did Harry Nilsson, bless him. And you could guess, you know, because Harry was rather fond of his sort of gin or tequila or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And he was the only Mountie with his buttons done up the wrong way. And when he took a bow, he kept on going and ended up in the orchestra pit.
And did everybody think in the audience, oh, well, it's just, that's part of the gag? And,
well,
and it
exactly,
wasn't,
yeah. I mean, the mercy was he wasn't hurt in any way.
But what I didn't realize was that then there was this tradition from the touring of a famous person in the Mounties, because at the tribute concert to George Harrison that was done, what, about 2 years ago now?
Yeah.
What was it, Tom Hanks?
Tom Hanks,
was hidden,
yeah,
in amongst the Mounties there.
Absolutely.
He was
like a dog with three tails. He was really thrilled to be a Mountie. He was such a nice guy. I mean, I've met my share of, you know, big celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, you know, I wouldn't, you know,
tell
the story again, but Tom Hanks is a total gent and a really good sport.
All right, who's really awful? You have to say. Just one name.
No.
Oh, please, one person. It can be dead.
It erases negative thoughts. I don't have...
I kind of get that from your music and the whole outlook of it. It's kind of a spiritual thing, which we'll get into shortly. But we're still in sort of the Python era. If you can give me kind of a quick sketch of your thoughts about the different Pythons, working with them, or just their basic personalities. I mean, I think we all kind of guess or know what they're like, but maybe some light you could shed on the different folks, like Michael Palin.
Right, Michael Palin is genuinely a nice guy. I mean, he is the nice one. He's sort of somebody who's been described as terminally nice, you know. We've been friends as a family, because he was married with two children. We've been married the same length of time. About 37 years.
Oh, wow.
And so we've always been more for family contact then. And also and Terry Jones,
right,
who used to write with Michael. Terry is an academic. He really is a really good history scholar.
Oh, Chaucer scholar, yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, in fact, waffling around, you know, why John Cleese left, you know, because Eric wrote him a cheeky letter, so because Eric was thinking about leaving. He said, how do you leave Python? You know, and anyway, Cleese was sort of saying, well, basically, I got tired of arguing with Jones, because, you know, John is a very methodical, trained as a lawyer,
mm-hmm,
and wants to make points, and sort of goes like this and goes like that. And then Terry gets bored with this, and then we'll sort of say things, golly, you know, trees are so green. and after a few years of Terry doing this to John, who's being very methodical and analytical, he got tired of it. So, oh, golly, I'm skipping all over them. So, but
well, that's
Eric,
fine.
Eric was the only one who ever wrote on his own, funnily enough. Because Michael always wrote with Graham Chapman.
John wrote with Graham, and Michael wrote with Terry.
I'm sorry, yes, John Cleese wrote with Graham Chapman,
mm-hmm,
and Michael wrote with Terry, and Eric wrote on his own, and Terry Gilliam was Terry Gilliam, you know.
Right.
Terry Gilliam and I used to share dressing rooms on the road, you know, because they put the two art students together, you know.
Right. And any thoughts about him? I mean, did you realize early on that he would become...
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I've always thought he was a genius, because I thought his animations were superb.
Mm.
You know, and I also like, you know, the Robert Crumb comics, and he knew Robert Crumb and things like that. So it was all part of the excitement of the ideas that were going around at the time. And, of course, we did kind of speak the same language visually and things like that.
Let me ask about Graham Chapman.
Well, Graham was as inspired. I think first and foremost, I think he was a fantastic actor.
Yes.
But he had this wonderful sense of humor. You know, in fact, John says the first time he met him in Cambridge was he saw somebody looking through a pillar box, you know, the English sort of letter boxes where you mail in letters.
Oh, yes.
He was looking in the slit of it and winding a handle like it was one of those peekaboo shows, you know, with the flick. Photographs, what the butler saw, they call them here.
Right.
I don't know if you've ever had them over there.
Well, I guess in the early days of peep shows.
Yeah, let us down on Coney Island and things like
right.
that. So anyway, you know, to Cleese's legal mind, you know, seeing somebody doing this, you know, must have been quite intriguing. But they obviously work really well, you know, sort of with Graham, John's kind of methodical kind of approach, and Graham's sort of mad, you know, inspired kind of ideas.
But unfortunately, fall down drunk towards the, you know.
Well, he did drink a bit, yes. But then he stopped, you know. By the life of Brown, he was a saint.
Well, he had to be on that film, yeah. I mean, he had to promise, I think, not to. And then, you know, he got...
Yeah, no, but I mean, he was a doctor. He knew exactly what was happening to him.
Yeah.
So, I mean, everything, you know, I mean, when I was writing with him, in fact, we went for a lunch with some of his medical friends. They're all doctors, and they all started doing, waffling on about this and that, you know, and I did feel a bit left out. And Graham was aware of that, and he said, I'm really sorry, Alfie, you know, you've got, you know, you can get me back, you know, I owe you one. And then a week or so later, I think, my old art school invited me to come and see what the art students of that year had been doing for their final show. I thought, perfect, they invited me to lunch, so I invited Graham to come with me. And he was wonderful, you know, because it was just as boring for him as it had been for me. But especially when we went outside, and this art student, it could have been Damien Hirst for all I know, because he went to the same college. But he had about 18 other students sort of sat in a kind of semicircle of chairs, and they all had a plastic instrument with which to toot and blow, and bits of strings came from their seats. So any time he pulled a string, they had to toot their instrument.
Cool.
Mm. And then Graham sort of decided to light his pipe and roll over on his back with his legs and arms in the air like a dead insect. Which, it went very well.
I can imagine.
It was wonderful. He was very good. You think of him in the wrestling thing.
Oh, of course.
He can adopt a very good comic, you know, dead insect, I suppose. And it was wonderful because the people trying to assess this sort of stupid art student for doing this could hardly keep a straight face.
You should have gotten an A. Absolutely.
Oh, well, they should have done, yes, of course.
I'd like to propose a toast.
Big deal. I'd like to propose a toasty, a tasty, toasty sub sandwich from Quiznos, like spicy Monterey Club, mesquite chicken, or smoked turkey on rosemary parmesan bread, all made with quality ingredients like freshly sliced premium meats, crisp vegetables, and rich melted cheeses. And the bread, oven-toasted artisan bread the old-fashioned way.
I'll drink to that.
At Quiznos, you can sip a soft drink or one of their flavorful hearty soups. They've also got desserts and snacks, or you can keep an eye on carbs with toasty flatbreads and fresh, craveable salads like Roadhouse Ranch and Yin Yang Chicken.
Aren't they the best?
They sure are. Quiznos, now with a new store in Hewlett, Long Island, 1320 Broadway. Mention Dave's Gone By and get 10% off your meal. I'll drink to that.
Everybody rise!
Welcome back to the final moments of Dave's Gone By on this October 14th. Big thank yous to both my visitors in the neighborhood, Pamela Scott, directing Crimes of the Heart at the Schreiber Studio, 212-352-3101 for tickets, and Neil Innes, continuing my amazing conversation with him. There's more to come, all about the Ruggles and life after Python. We'll probably finish it up on the next episode, unless it's bumped by another guest. Won't know that for a few days, so check my website, DavesGoneBy.com, to see what'll be on. And check NeilInnes.org to see what he's up to. It is a major site with bunches of songs you can listen to for free, and vintage videos, too. All there with just the click of a mouse, NeilInnes.org. I-N-N-E-S. And WGBB is how we spell this radio station. It's where you'll find a bunch of other shows to listen to throughout the week. Long Island's Dating, Fridays at 6, Mr. Redman, Saturdays 7:30, followed by Mikey and Jimmy at 9. Your World with Joe Salzone, Sundays at 7, with election coverage Monday evening 2. Wednesdays at 11, call in to psychic advice giver Joyce Keller. Thursdays at 6, Larry Davidson hosting WGBB Tonight. 8 on Thursdays, it's Mike Shinneri with Smooth Jazz. And Thursdays in between, Dave's Gone By, of course. Oh, and a reminder, for a while, I've been having a second show on Thursday nights, Filler Up. Just an hour of music and a little talk. Program director Tom Ross has been very supportive of that show, and it's not going away. It's just moving a little later in the evening. Depending on the night, you might find it at 8:30 or 9, but for the most part, Filler Up will still be here on Thursdays, brand new shows, just like Dave's Gone By, which, by the way, is supported by three very excellent sponsors: Tasty Toasty Quiznos of Hewlett, 1320 Broadway for lunch or dinner, and Hewlett Minuteman Press. If it involves paper or printing, they can do it, and reasonably too. And Total Theater, publishers of Performing Arts Insider Theater Magazine. TotalTheater.com is the place for subscription information and more. And the place to be next week, October 21st, is here for the 98th edition of Dave's Gone By. I want to thank you for being with me this week and every week. Thanks also to my wonderful wife, Joyce, for all her encouragement and love. And big thank you to Dr. Demento. I didn't have time to mention it, but Dr. Demento played a song of mine on his syndicated radio show this past weekend. He played my tribute to Jeopardy! Ken. Ken Jennings, the wunderkind who's just been running the board over and over on Jeopardy! I played the song here a few weeks back, sent it in to Dr. D, and he played it alongside Weird Al Yankovic's I Lost on Jeopardy! So, of course, I'm thrilled. Everybody write or email Dr. Demento and request the song. I don't figure it'll make the funny five, but maybe they'll play it again when Ken finally loses. There's a rumor that happens in November. Anyway, thank you, Dr. Demento, for making another dream come true of mine, getting on your show. As for my show, next week, as I said, I think I'll finish up the Innes interview, do the news gone by, start getting ready for the 100th anniversary show in a couple of weeks. So be here with me, 7 p.m., October 21st, for the 98th edition of Dave's Gone By. Until then, don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night. I'll take Dr. Demento for 2000, Alex. And gone by. Deep in his bank account, he's put $1 million. Some call it genius, while others call it luck. He looks like something that fell off a turnip truck. Everybody sing, hey, Jeopardy Ken, do it again. Jeopardy Ken, hey, Jeopardy Ken, what did you win, Jeopardy Ken? He comes from Utah and his brother picks his ties. Oh, look, he won again. Surprise, surprise, surprise. He's such a marvel, he's the devil in disguise. All the Mormons sing, hey, Jeopardy Ken, do it again. Jeopardy Ken, hey, Jeopardy Ken, what did you win, Jeopardy Ken? He's just as smug as a computer geek can be. All the suspense is gone by Final Jeopardy. But no one else can run the board on Potpourri. Alex Trebek sings, hey, Jeopardy Ken, do it again. Jeopardy Ken, hey, Jeopardy Ken, what did you win? Jeopardy Ken, hey, Jeopardy Ken, do it again. Jeopardy Ken, hey, Jeopardy Ken, what did you win? Jeopardy Ken.